Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real-life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castagnini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's show. Today is going to be a really fun podcast for you to listen to. This guest is such a great conversationalist, and we had such a good time talking. We went all over the place, but really, I want you to ask yourself, like, what if your nutrition stopped feeling like such a rule book, and it just started feeling like eating was relief or something that wasn't such a struggle? Today, I'm joined by Dahlia Kinsey, a queer Black registered dietitian and holistic wellness practitioner who helps people make eating easy and joyful again. That might be hard for some people listening who are struggling with food or in the middle of treatment or disordered eating. I guess it's really hard. And a lot of people I talk to in sessions, they say, gosh, I can't even imagine enjoying eating again or not struggling. So today, we're really going to dig into why fear-based food rules backfire, how culture and community shape our relationships with food, and what truly supportive care looks like when you're tired of diet culture. So we could sit back, relax, just hear what Dahlia has to say, because she's got a lot of great information and she's just a joy to listen to. Look forward to bringing her on, and again, just having you sit back and enjoy this conversation. All right, Dahlia, welcome to the show. I'm really happy you're here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay, so I want to just delve into things, but before we do that, I'd like to hear a little bit more about you and how you got into the field and doing what you're doing.
Well, I'm a registered dietitian with a real holistic focus. I got into nutrition because I was raised to think that food is very powerful when it comes to healing and supporting the body. And I mistakenly believed that would be like the focus if you were a nutrition major, but it was really more centered on everything comes down to weight control and blaming the individual and blaming like the public for all of their health concerns that could be supported or improved by food, and just ignoring all the other factors at play in the States. So it took a while after finishing my studies to figure out how do I want to use this in a way that feels true to me and is in fact evidence-based, because a lot of those assumptions they're making, absolutely not supported by science, even though the whole point of the field is to be evidence-based. That's supposed to be the big difference between a dietitian and a nutritionist. So it took a while to get to my current point, but my main focus is making eating easy and joyful. There's a lot of barriers in between my clients and getting to that point, but that is generally the distinction between me and a lot of other like preventative health dietitians you meet, is that if you're not having fun with your food, or at a minimum feeling neutral about it, what are we even doing? At least that's my take on it.
I love that, because I'm wondering, where did we lose that? Because I know food is fuel and nutrition, right? I get that. But like, it is supposed to be, I think, like enjoyable too, right? If you think about it, when we have holidays, events, celebrations, birthdays, whatever, it's like food's there, right? And so it's become so much less enjoyable, right? If we talk about like many people listening, right? It becomes this thing that you try to control, or it's diet food. That's not fun. That's right. Less than fun. That's something else.
A lot of people are afraid of food at this point, which takes it to a whole new level. And you can even see diet culture's influence at those food-centered holidays, because people, even though they say that they're not dieting, they genuinely feel like they're not dieting. The average person operates under so many food rules. The holiday meals are an outlier, and people treat it like, this is the last time I'm ever going to get a slice of pie. Like, never again will I be able to have these things that are available here. And people eat to the point of being physically ill. That's common. You hear about people needing to lay down and sleep. Fine. Tryptophan is a real thing. But if you are too stuffed to move after your Thanksgiving meal, you have been restricting. I don't see any other way you can get to that point, because nobody enjoys being physically ill. So stuffed, if they burp, it could be vomit. Like, people know that feeling. Like, even people who don't have disordered eating patterns, most of us have done that at least once or twice, maybe as a kid. And then you realize, oh, this is not enjoyable. So even when people are going into celebrations, it's still not fun because of that pressure. I will not be able to have this again. I'm going to have to be good starting tomorrow. Yeah, it's, I don't know when it gets lost, but it is so far in our review, like, the concept that food should be enjoyable, that it's strange for clients to hear. And I usually get a lot of pushback. People don't believe you can enjoy your food and be okay.
This whole concept of food being enjoyable, almost, oh, if it's enjoyable, then it must be like I'm doing something quote unquote bad and feel guilty. Right. And if I'm enjoying my food, like I talk to a lot of people, they have the good food, bad food list, right? Which I try to work on people with, there's no good or bad foods, but it's almost this idea of, and I'd love to hear your take on this because you're a dietitian, right? And I'm a psychologist, but if it tastes good and I'm enjoying it, then I must feel guilty because that means I'm doing something that's going to cause my body to look a certain way that I don't want it to. And if I'm eating the quote unquote good foods, then I feel good. I'm doing something good. And then my body's going to look quote unquote good, like the diet foods. And so I'm wondering your take on that.
It can definitely be a hard sell because people aren't used to hearing it. But I get a lot of folks who are not happy with their body or their blood work at this point because of issues with insulin resistance, that the problem is they constantly undereat. They get up early in the morning, they don't eat. There are all these cute names for it now, like intermittent fasting, which fasting itself, normal, exists in cultures all over the world for different reasons, not for the sake of starving yourself, usually for some sort of spiritual or like psychological benefit or whatever. But the concept that it is good to not eat. Anytime you can avoid eating, you should do that. If you're not hungry, don't look at it. If you can wait a little bit longer and drink some water or smell a piece of celery, like whatever it's going to take, if you can eat less, that's better for you. That's a deeply entrenched belief, even among people who aren't really restricting themselves. They think being able to just be hungry is going to be helpful. But if you get up and you're already having that natural cortisol surge that helps you wake up in the morning, helps everybody wake up in the morning, if you choose to eat absolutely nothing and just have something with caffeine, like a black coffee, because it's still going to keep you in that fasted range for your keto focus or your intermittent fasting focus, that makes, like, you're putting yourself on a roller coaster, blood sugar roller coaster for the rest of the day. So there's so many ways in which refusing to eat encourages weight gain. And sometimes the only way I can get people to eat is to keep showing them, like, what you're doing is going to make you heavier than you are already right now, and you're already deeply uncomfortable. But then it keeps becoming more and more obvious in the following appointments that if they don't also get help from a therapist, a psychologist, they won't ever be in a safe place. So I am really pushing, like, to try and get them to eat right now. But even having to play those mental games, that's not great. It would be ideal if you could get to the point where you trust that you always deserve food and you don't need to constantly be punishing yourself and rewarding yourself with food. That's not the way your relationship with food has to be, and it really isn't supportive. And is your physical appearance the only thing you're worried about, or would you like to live a long, comfortable life? Because starting out with disordered eating in your 20s and your 30s, that's setting you up for a lot of health complications down the road. But all of the diet culture messaging is, if you manage to be thin, you will be healthy. And that is not how that works. Like, under eating for years will cause you serious health problems, and people die from eating disorders all the time. So it's not cute. It's not something to take lightly. It's a very serious health issue that unfortunately is constantly being encouraged and validated by the wellness industry overall.
You know, and I want to go back to what you said, because I think people don't really realize that it's so unfortunate to me to hear that in order to really hook people, from what you're saying, it's almost like you have to use the toxic diet culture messaging of, hey, if you don't eat, then your biggest fear is going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, the sad part. It's like you almost have to play into the fat phobia to hook people, to get them to listen to you. Hey, if you don't eat, you're going to gain weight over time.
Right.
And that to me is almost like, ouch, like that, it feels icky to me, because I don't want to play into the fat phobia messaging of, oh, do this or else this might happen, or this might be a long-term consequence. Right? Cause I even hate that with dieting. It's, oh, we know that people who chronically diet or yo-yo diet over time, that's what the body does. But I hate saying that, because it's almost like I'm saying, oh, don't diet because this will happen, even though it's more to the fact of what you're saying of there's health consequences.
It feels very gross, because it feels like we're still saying in that appointment that to be large or to be fat, and I say that from the standpoint of a lot of people in fat liberation circles embrace that as a neutral term, saying I have brown eyes. Like, why would I feel bad about having brown eyes? It's neutral. I'm not super hyped about having brown eyes. I don't care. It's neutral, right? So a lot of people use fat as a neutral descriptor, which I think is very helpful and healthy. But if you come at somebody who is still under the spell of diet culture and fat phobia and this drive for thinness, oh, they will be out of there so quickly. And especially when people come in like with visible signs of malnutrition, I am so fixated on getting them to eat something that I'm not willing to be as much of a straight shooter as I naturally am, because I know that's not going to work and they're going to leave. But it feels very gross acting like I believe there's a wrong type of body. Because if you don't at some point come to terms with the fact that a body can be neutral, I don't see how you will stay in recovery, because there are natural things that will come up in your life where weight gain is normal. And if you haven't accepted that, like, change is what you can expect from the body, like no matter how used to it you get, like you do all the work to accept your now body, hang on, because it's going to change again, right? So the real goal is to get to the point where you can feel a little bit more neutral about it, or maybe you can grieve the change, but not harm yourself in response to that. So there are definitely limits to like how much can the dietitian do for you. It depends on what state of recovery you're in. If it's early on and you're pretty sure you don't have an eating disorder, you know, we might be the first person who tries to refer you to somebody else, because all signs are pointing to you need extra support. If you've already maybe done an inpatient program and like you're being kind of de-escalated as far as the levels of care go, then sure, again, probably a great point for you to be with a dietitian and maybe nobody else. But at some point, you really are going to need somebody to help you look at these thought patterns and these underlying beliefs that once you don't have a meal plan, or once you gain weight because you had a baby, or you gain weight because you broke your foot and you couldn't go running every day, which I probably didn't even know you were doing, because people tell me all kinds of things and I just believe, because I'm not the food police and I'm not going to dig in there and be like, are you sure? I don't do as much challenging. I feel like your therapist is going to catch you. Like, I know my therapist always catches me in my delusions of not noticing that I'm still engaging in like a harmful behavior, but I do know enough to not mention it to another healthcare provider. The therapist will get it out of me. So it's important to be open to being referred to an additional provider for support. Even if you think you don't need it, when you're looking back at this time, like a year from now, you may very well realize you desperately needed that extra support.
And I appreciate that, because it is a team effort. It's a collaborative treatment plan or team. So I very much value having patients that I refer to a dietitian, especially being that someone who's knowledgeable about eating disorders. I think that's key. Also, a medical doctor who's knowledgeable about eating disorders. When you have the right team, it's very valuable, and everybody does their own thing. I can't run labs, and I don't want to spend time doing meal plans or talking about nutrition, or it's out of my scope of practice anyway. And I'm assuming for you too, like, you don't have time to focus on everything. Like, you don't have time to sit there and get into the cognitions or their fears or all that kind of stuff. So it's very beneficial to have a team. And so I'm curious though, do you ever get pushback from people if you refer them to see a therapist to work on the deeper things?
It's usually the people that I'm concerned about the most that push back the hardest. But a lot of people are open to it, or they'll disclose, I was seeing somebody, but I felt like things weren't changing fast enough, and I just want this to be over. It's usually the people who are tired of being afraid of food, and they're tired of, they can feel that it's causing them a lot of upset and anxiety. The back and forth. It's usually people who know up here, like cognitively, I have issues with diet culture and the concept of these beauty standards, but I've been immersed in this so long, I don't know how to create some distance between me and they've done the cycle, weight cycling. They're starting to have some health problems that could very well be more related to the weight cycling than being at a higher weight. But they do have some very real concerns that require attention, but they feel that it's impossible for them to move forward alone. They know that they need help. They don't know what it needs to look like. They're open to it. But people are very busy. People, if you're dealing with working class clients, which almost all of my clients are middle class people, so we have a lot of resources, like financially, but we are time poor, like across the board. Usually middle-class people are time poor. So when you tell a middle-class person, I need you to carve out an extra hour or maybe 2 hours because you got to get there or whatever, you got to do something with your kids or your other distractions so you can be by yourself long enough to focus with your therapist, people aren't excited about that because it's going to require some maneuvering. But a lot of the people come to me, they already figured they should do that. So there's not as much of a battle. What I have been running across with some of my Gen Z clients, with them being digital natives and everything, I think there is a little bit of a breakdown in their understanding of like why people specialize. Because like you said, like maybe there isn't time to get into certain things in session and we want to stay in our zone of genius. But also, I can't pretend that I magically know what you know about supporting people with habit change or, you know, how to support somebody who clearly has trauma. I don't want to trigger somebody when they don't have the support system that they need. Or like a therapist can spot, you're well-resourced enough for us to start having this conversation, and I may not be able to tell. I look for a lot of signs of distress that signal there's a bigger, deeper issue here. I should back off and move on to something else. And then later when it's feeling like less charged, tell them, you know what? I think it would be really great for you to talk to somebody about that who can really help you without harming you. That's the issue when you are operating outside of your specialty. And that's also the issue with using technology in lieu of a live professional person. Like generally, if you're using an LLM like ChatGPT, it is defaulting to agreeing with you and validating all of your current beliefs in a way that a therapist would never do. Like they may let you say whatever you want to say and believe whatever you want to believe while you're building rapport. But eventually, they're going to help you understand the difference between your distortions and the actual truth that would support you more. But ChatGPT will likely never pick up on that. And it's also likely to encourage you to stay where you are and just keep affirming that what you're doing, feeling, and thinking is not an issue.
Which is scary to me. And also, my understanding, and I'm not well-versed in all this, is still new to me, but my understanding is that picks up information from the web. And so I'm thinking about all the information that's out there on the web, and it's very toxic in terms of diet culture. So I'm just imagining it's going to pick up some like toxic diet culture messaging and reiterate that to the person of what it, that scares me. I don't know what it would pull up. I don't know what it would tell the person, but I can't imagine it would all be sound advice or sound messaging at all. Yeah. There's a bunch of crap out there, like bad things out there that I would be very cautious about it giving.
And your prompt can make a big difference. Yeah. But if you are in a place with a lot of distortions, your prompt is not going to elicit an evidence-based response. Right. When I'm in there wanting to not be bothered with reading a lot of abstracts, wanting to go straight to the study I need, I'm giving it parameters. Mm. Like, for I want it to have been reviewed by maybe this journal, that journal, whatever. I want it to be less than 10 years old. I want this research to have a pool of at least this many people in the different control groups, like whatever. I would search for that. But when I'm even searching in my own life for stuff where I basically want something to reflect back to me, you're right, and give me examples. Let's say I'm trying to revise a recipe and I believe it can be done a certain way. I'm not going to ask like an open-ended question, what's the best way to do this? Give me some examples. Give me the rationale. I'm going to say, I have this. I'm going to do this. Tell me I'm right, basically. How do I do it? And then when it combs the net, it's going to pull examples of people being along the same line of logic or reasoning, and it's going to feed that back to me. So I know I do that when I'm looking for stuff that's not based on my actual health. But I think a lot of people, when they're writing these prompts, they're leaving them very wide open. And you're right. It even combs Reddit threads. And I like Reddit, but there's a lot of stuff on Reddit that clearly needs to be ignored.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. So
is that horrifying? You're like,
my head is spinning with thoughts about that because look, it's true. It's scary. I've been in this field for decades and I know it's so hard for people when I went through this too. I was given a meal plan when I was sick and it was like, what? Like one meal scared me. Like, it was so scary. Yeah. So you can imagine when people are working with you, it's so scary. So it's so important to have support of a therapist or a team to help people through that, especially just to be like, wait a minute, this is so counter to what the messaging is. And there wasn't even social media when I was going through this, showing me like what I eat in a day or all the different diets you could Google or whatever. I'm just imagining somebody going to ChatGPT after they meet with you and going, is this what I'm supposed to eat? And it going, no, that's more than whatever, based on whatever they pull from the web and then validating, again, to your point, what they believe already. And that is so detrimental because you're the expert and you know what the human body needs for survival and for nutrition and to be healthy as physically, right? And to see you and be given that information, especially if they're ill with an eating disorder, for recovery. There's a different level of what people need to eat on a meal plan when they're recovering versus not, and up to different levels of care to restore nutrition. There's a different meal plan versus not, and that can be very scary.
And I would definitely want that to be, like, the doctor's got to be involved. There have to be labs. It's the concept of somebody being ready for support, wanting to get better, and then dying from refeeding syndrome is like my nightmare.
Right.
So I'm absolutely not out here trying to fly solo when other healthcare providers need to be involved. And that should be a red flag to listeners, is if you're going to a single healthcare provider and they say, they basically imply they have everything they need, they know everything they need to know to help you get better. Eating disorder treatment is so niche, and it seems like the recommendations on best practices could use some firming up. They're all over the place. So a lot of people that actually can help you with your eating disorder, like 70% of what they know is from actually doing the job and interpreting other research that's out there, making it fit, basically, because you're not going to find a ton of just straight up eating disorder research that can be helpful for all the different kinds of clients you're going to get, with like different motivations behind the restriction. Really, the causes are all over the place, but generally all I ever heard is, first of all, they barely cover it in school, number one. Secondly, so much of what they teach you when you're becoming a dietitian is how to encourage disordered eating. But it's good when the person is overweight. Mind you, it's like the same stuff that will like stop you from breathing. When I see somebody with these visible collarbones and just their bones just so visible at their wrists, you know, you're concerned. You're like, this person is starving to death right in front of us. Food all over the place and they're starving to death. Get this person help right away. But at the same time, that same behavior, like counting your calories, weighing all your food, blah, 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 that's generally accepted for a larger person. Even if that person has an eating disorder, people will continue to recommend that they keep restricting. So just be careful when you're looking for support. And if somebody makes it clear, like, I am not all knowing, I'm here to support you and learn how to best support you, the individual, then that's a green flag. I've honestly been shocked a couple of times when I thought I was doing so good, so trauma-informed or trauma-aware, whichever is the one that communicates, I don't know as much about what I'm doing. Like, I'm trying to be aware. But people bursting into tears, explaining why they didn't keep a food journal. Mind you, all food journaling with me is just a photo. No calories, no nothing. But seeing people who said, oh yeah, I'm in recovery. Or sometimes a lot of people say, I've never gotten official treatment because every single space I went into was so anxiety provoking, I couldn't stay there. Like trans masked people who were assigned female at birth, who go into a lot of clinics and everybody there is like very femme, cisgender, white lady with money, it looks like. So even some of the lower income white people I work with will say, I just didn't feel comfortable there. Or some of the heavy people with eating disorders said, I just felt uncomfortable, because they kept talking about how we were going to nourish ourselves but avoid being fat, essentially, as part of the counseling. Which, fair enough, that's essentially what I'm saying one-on-one to people when I'm desperate to get them to eat. It's like trying to appeal with where they are at the moment. How can I make you eat right now? Like months from now, years from now, I hope you know this was just to get you to eat. But imagine being in a group session where part of the support is telling people it is safe to eat and not get fat while you're sitting there fat. Like what? Of course you're not going to be comfortable there. So I give people who either haven't received treatment or were basically told you're okay, generally because they're not underweight, but it's very obvious they have an eating disorder. But the point of a lot of these exercises, usually with the journaling, is they have a specific lab we're trying to get under control. And I want to see, where is it sneaking in? Because people with eating disorders generally know so much about food. Whatever's giving them the high cholesterol, it's something sneaky. So I'm wanting to catch it with the diary. And I think based on what the person told me and my limited understanding as a dietitian, not a psychologist, I'm like, oh, this is going to be fine. But then when they are like crying and saying, I thought about canceling, I didn't want you to know, I felt like such a failure. Every time I tried to do it, like my heart raced, and I'm like, whoa, did I make a mistake? This is me. I totally misunderstood where you were with this. We're going to, don't you ever track again. Mm-hmm. If I forget, tell me no. But clearly this is triggering for you, and that was not my intention. And they usually don't even remember why we were tracking. Mm-hmm. Had nothing to do with weight. In their mind, it's become like this moral failing, and that they were being asked to document being bad, which was absolutely not what we discussed. But this is what happens when you are being forced to step outside of your scope because people aren't getting the care that they need.
But there's so much shame with eating disorders too, so that totally makes sense. And there's so much secrecy with it too, with these illnesses. Right. And I think that's part of what you're talking about. And let's just talk it out. It's no, look, we're seeping in toxic diet culture messaging. Right. It is so normal to want to fit the norm, to look like the norm, to look like the standards that are out there, because there's so much pressure. Let's just call it out. There's so much pressure. Right. And the messaging is so loud, right? It is. It's so loud. And so it can feel very confusing, I think, to be like, wait a minute, you're telling me, Dahlia, to like do this, to eat these foods, that it's okay. And the messaging out when I leave your office after 45 minutes or an hour is completely opposite. It's saying, don't do this, don't eat this, don't look like this, don't, you know, and it feels like very contradictory and scary. It is still scary, right? And and then when I get people in my office, they're like, I don't know what to do. I'm scared. I'm still fearing these things. Like, my body feels out of control. All of this feels very out of control, very scary. There's a lot of mistrust. And so it takes, I think, a long time to just trust the professionals. Can I even trust you? It's like a lot of people say it's called free falling. They're like, I'm trusting you, but I don't know if I can, because they almost trust the eating disorder more, or the rules of the diet more, because that's what they know. It feels safer.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And in the cases where people have shared that, I was like, okay, this is great. This is a learning moment for me. I'm glad you said something, or I'm glad you couldn't not cry in this situation, because what a shame it would have been if you just gave up right here and kept trying to manage it on your own. Mm-hmm. It's like taking up so much of your life trying to survive with this eating disorder with absolutely no support, and other health problems like popping up. Like, the cardiovascular health problems are really common, especially if it's been a long time, like years and years of under eating, or like restricting and then binging, but then purging and still losing a lot of your nutrients. There's just, it's so stressful for the body. So some support's better than none at all. I'm, of course, always advocating for them to get a little bit more. But just like most people that I think really specialize in eating disorder care, you learn as you go. That's not the way it should be, ideally. But at this time, that's really the way that it is. You think of all these different entities that help with structured eating disorder treatment training. But even that's disjointed. If you're becoming a nurse, there's like certain things that must be covered in order for you to sit for your board exams. And there's really no such unifying factor among healthcare providers when it comes to spotting and treating eating disorder. Everybody's training is all over the place.
And I'm curious for you, like, how did you get so well-versed in eating disorders? Because I know for psychologists, and therapist. We have our certified eating disorder specialty through IDEP and things. So I'm just curious for you, what is there for people maybe listening, wondering, okay, where did you get, was it more just working with people over time, or is there places where dietitians and nutritionists can get more training?
Some people do go the IDEP route. It has been a lot of working with people one-on-one, but also there are some continuing ed resources that speak more to the population that comes to me the most often, which would be queer people and people of color. And these are people who frequently are not going to go through another more like standardized eating disorder treatment program mm-hmm. because it doesn't feel like a welcoming space mm-hmm. to a lot of people. So I have gotten training from, now I'm trying to remember the name of the conference. It's escaping me right now, but I can give it to you so you can put it in the show notes. But there are a couple of dietitians of color in particular that specialize in eating disorder treatment. And it's been a lot through the demand repeatedly coming up because of the clients. Not that's what they started out wanting to do. Because that's also not what I started out wanting to do. I like general wellness. It's like really fun to me. I'm into herbalism. I like focusing on things being lighter and enjoyable, like using it as a way to feel a sense of whimsy in your day. It's a time for you to be grounded and present when you feel comfortable with food. Like these are all the great things that can happen with food. But then it just keeps coming up that people don't have that type of relationship with food. And they feel like erased when they do go into other spaces for support. Like it's just, I'm what they have. So I've been having to seek out aligned training opportunities when I feel like they arise. But a lot of the support I end up giving is going to lean toward a community element because a lot of cultures from the African diaspora, including like African Americans and Caribbean people, since that's generally who I feel like I'm working with the most, community is going to be a big part of the healing process. So like you're not going to do it alone. It isn't about just you. So maybe you're going to be there and a parent's going to be there, even if you're an adult, or you're going to be there and a sibling or a cousin or something. Like a lot of folks operate with the whole family and they wouldn't really want support for just them alone, which may not make a lot of sense in different clinical contexts. So there's like small things that tend to look differently. Helping people green light foods that culturally are important to them. But if they're in a culture whose food culture is always getting pooped on as unhealthy and just irresponsible, they may be extra afraid of these foods, but it's also interfering with their sense of community and safety with their family and their close circle. Because like you mentioned, a lot of eating together is about celebrating and it's a big part of socializing. So if you're in a culture that's all about community, not individual first and then immediate family, and then, you know, you go out from there, not having that sense of connection through food just makes life a little bit harder. And who needs that? When you're trying to manage any kind of illness, physical, psychological, you don't need the extra stress. You need more support and more gentleness and more permission to take it easy in other areas while you get stronger in the area where you need immediate assistance.
Yeah, and I just want to bring that up too, because I think I hear oftentimes there's like almost mixed messaging with cultural stuff too. It's almost, oh, enjoy the foods, but then there's a shaming of, oh, it's disrespectful if you don't enjoy the foods that's there, but then there's a lot of body shaming if your body doesn't meet the cultural norm of that culture, and family members can shame the person. So it's almost, wait a minute, this is very uncomfortable. I don't know if you find that at all.
That is a great point. Oh, 100%, even in my own life. So it's really relatable when people bring it up, because I was a very bony teenager. And I lived in like most places, in the, not most places, in the South, in the U.S., a lot of areas are like 40% Black, 60% white. You don't come across white people in the areas that I was raised in that aren't familiar with Black people. Like, you all grow up shoulder to shoulder. And I was constantly being told by white friends and like community members and friends, oh, you're looking so great. Oh, you look like a model. Look at how you're growing up. Oh, my goodness. People praising the thinness. Mm. And then whenever I was with family and other Black people, all I could hear about was how I needed to eat more. I literally had a cousin who every time I saw her, I don't know how she must have just kept a candy bar around for me. She would literally throw food and throw candy at me and candy bars saying, you need to do something about this situation. My skinny body was called a situation. Oh, wow. Okay. And it wasn't like underweight skinny. Like, I wore a size 2 as a teenager. That's not weird. That's normal. You can see the difference in how the body tends to change. Looking at junior sizes, no hips, minimal waist, then you get to the ladies section and then the women's section. You can see how the body tends to change if, like, you're a person with femme hormones. Like, it's normal. But even though I know they knew it was normal, they thought it was funny because you're an outlier and this is not considered a cute body in the culture. But then when I gained weight, oh, you should have heard the fat phobia. It's, oh, you've overcorrected. Oh, you look like you ate the kid I used to know. Like, it was ridiculous. I'm like, you kept pressuring me to eat, and now you've got all this to say. Only because I was raised in a household where my dad is very weight neutral, and the other side of the family, absolutely not. They perceive heavyweight as you've gotten too American, because before they moved here, like from Cuba and from Jamaica, they had never seen somebody as large as Americans tend to be, and they're not into it. So it was a lot of conflicting messaging, like having Black Southern Americans take on body image, Caribbean people's take on body image, and then the dominant culture's take on body image. So you could never be right. But what that did for me, with the help of my dad's like weight neutrality, is set the boundary that nobody needs to be policing my body, period. Don't worry about how skinny it is. Don't worry about how fat it is. And it is what it is, right? The body is constantly adjusting in relation to its environment and your hormonal changes and your age. And that's fine. The problem is people need to stop trying to tell your body what to do. We don't really have as much direct control over it as we think. And it's also none of their business. And there's a Jamaican expression that every pot has its cover. So if you're worried, oh, I'm going to be unlovable and whatever, not true. Every pot has its cover. You'll be fine, right? And the people who love you wouldn't care if you're missing two eyes and you have an ear for a nose. They don't, your body is not all that you are. But without his clarity on that, because he struggled with his weight as a child, I don't think I would have come to that conclusion within a reasonable amount of time. And it's very impressive for him, because you know how men and body image, like, is a very recent thing that cis straight guys are contemplating, like, oh, this might be affecting me. And my dad is a baby boomer, and he had felt what it was like to be at the receiving end of fat phobia, and he rejected it.
It sounds like he was an amazing influence on you, and I love that message. I think let's end on this positive note, and I hope that people take this, because I love having inspirational thoughts for people to leave with, because that's really what I want people to take away from this, is like having more hope, having a new thought, maybe that's away from all the thoughts and messaging that's out there that are toxic and away from what you actually look like. Because to your point, our bodies are going to change. I always say this to people, 5 years old, you didn't look like you did at 15 or 20. And right. At 20, you're not going to look like you do at 80. It's, your body is going to change. It's just inevitable. So if you're so focused on keeping your body looking the way it does right now, like, good luck to you, because it's not. it's not at all.
Yeah. That's well said. I like the 5-year-old. That feels more neutral. Because it's also normal to grieve it because, like you said, we're surrounded by this. But as long as you know it, you can be aware of it. And it really gives you such greater access to happiness if you just have that in the back of your head. Because as my hair is graying and things are not looking 20, I had to confront with, oh, this is a new area in which I get to accept that the body will change and no one's ever going to card me again. And that's okay. But you just, what you're doing is very helpful because sometimes you hear the concept and you're not ready to fully process it, but at least it's there. It's simmering. It's in the back somewhere. So hopefully when you really need it, like when the body changes again, you'll remember, oh yeah, my worth is not defined by this body and I'm going to be okay.
Yeah, I love that. Well, Dahlia, I know real quick before we end, I know you have a book, so I want to just have you mention that and then also how people can find you and work with you.
Yes, the book is called Decolonizing Wellness, a QT BIPOC centered guide to escaping the diet trap and achieving body liberation. It is focused on my favorite population, which is like other folks like me, queer plus people of color, more focused on Black people because obviously that's who I know the most about, but it is for everybody. And I've had a lot of readers from way outside of those identities who benefited from it. A lot of our ideas about what a perfect body is comes from really toxic places. And the best way to find me is just go to kinseywellness.com and you'll be able to see the little Beat the Binge guide that I have available for folks for free. It has a little mini meditation in it and just some tips or ideas about things that we frequently confuse with hunger and what could be behind our binge eating episodes, which, spoiler, is usually restriction.
Love it. Well, Dahlia, thank you so much. This has been wonderful to have you here and have all your information in the show notes. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners. So if you like the show, please rate and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation.